On the calendar. She was talking about.
Good afternoon to everyone. Today is the 22nd of February. This is the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. I know we've got a full agenda today and a lot of ground to cover, so I'm going to go ahead and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5512, and I'm going to invite Director Allen back, and we're going to hear in a little more detail today about the worker safety system.
Very good. Co-chair, members of the committee, again, Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Today we're going to spend the time with you giving you brief presentations on the various programmatic units within the agencies, and so we'll be cycling division administrators in and out as we do that. As you indicate, we're going to start with the worker safety system, which consists of Workers' Compensation Division, Oregon OSHA, the Workers' Compensation Board, and our ombudsman functions, and we'll talk about each of those. And with nothing more than that for wind-up, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Lou Savage, who runs the Workers' Compensation Division.
Well, welcome, Mr. Savage. We had a request from some of the House members that we spice up the hearings, and we were going to ask each presenter to begin with a song.
Well, you know, depending upon what genre you want, I might help you out.
Well, let's put that idea on hold for just a couple of minutes. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lou Savage. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division. As Pat mentioned yesterday, the division regulates and administers Oregon's workers' compensation system. Our goal is to ensure that workers receive prompt and complete medical treatment, as well as adequate and reasonable income benefits when either temporarily or permanently disabled from work. We also want to ensure that there is a fair and just administrative system, that workers are restored to self-sufficiency through our return to work programs, that employers and workers are protected by insurance as the sole and exclusive remedy for occupational injuries and diseases. And that means that workers will receive medical treatment and compensation for injuries at work, regardless of who's at fault, and that by having insurance, employers are shielded from lawsuits. And this also means that employers need to have workers' comp insurance. The division looks to ensure that if an employer does not have insurance, that we take remedial action. That being said, most employers do have insurance. We want to ensure that there's a level playing field, and the industry understands and appreciates that. Oregon's workers' compensation system is nationally recognized because we have one of the lowest cost systems in the country, while at the same time providing good benefits to workers. The most recent study of workers' compensation rates ranks Oregon as the seventh lowest in the country. This is one of the greatest achievements that the Oregon system has produced. Lower rates for employers over the course of several years, while keeping good benefits for workers
that are
adjusted over time to keep pace with the state average weekly wage.
This punctuality.
Good morning, Co-Chair.
Good morning.
Sorry, although it is afternoon. So in 1990 and 1995, the legislature enacted major reforms to the workers' compensation system. The results of those changes are the foundation of the successful system that we have today. These include improved worker safety, resulting in fewer injuries and fewer catastrophic injuries. And what that means is fewer permanently disabled workers. And when we say disabled, we mean a disabling claim where there's lost time and lost wages. And also fewer permanently and totally disabled workers, meaning we're helping more people get back to work. Because the division was concerned about injured workers' access to medical care, we worked to make it easier for medical providers to provide treatment by simplifying forms and other processes. In addition, the division's medical fee schedule helps to keep medical costs in check. The pure premium costs, that portion of the premium employers pay insurers to cover claims costs for job-related injuries, has decreased 8 of the last 10 years. And when workers are injured, improved medical treatment allows them to get back to work quicker. The Workers' Compensation Division's Medical Advisory Committee, which is primarily made up of medical practitioners, helps to provide new guidance on new trends in occupational medicine. And our employer and injury and preferred worker programs provide assistance to both workers and employers to allow the worker to get back to work. One of the foundations of the workers' compensation system in Oregon is the Management Labor Advisory Committee, which is commonly referred to as MLAC. This is a committee that's composed of five representatives, each from business and labor, appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. Since 1990, MLAC has provided recommendations to the legislature and the governor's office. And without MLAC as a vehicle for reaching consensus, we feel that the major structural changes in the system from one legislative session to another could erode the long-term stability of the system.
I'm going to interrupt you just long enough for the benefit of our new colleagues to say how valuable I have found MLAC in my legislative service. When you know that labor and management have taken the controversy into the hermetically sealed room and worked it out among themselves and come back to the legislature with something that they've all agreed on, it makes it pretty easy to get to yes because of the integrity and the high regard that MLAC is held in. And having the family work it out and come in here with a solution rather than making us pick is of enormous value.
Senator Johnson, we appreciate that. And some of these issues, as you know, are very complicated. And having the time for a labor management committee to really look at an issue in depth is very valuable.
And if I could just quickly add, in the light of day, it's a public process that is subject to open meetings, public records, all those kinds of things. And so it's not people, the hermetically sealed room is visible.
Thank you for correcting that. I was trying to be funny and have left a false impression. It is absolutely transparent and light of day, and I didn't mean in any way to diminish the value of the deliberations. Thank you for that correction.
So we wanted to highlight a few goals for the 2017-2019 biennium. The division is working with other divisions in DCBS to identify shared processes that will help us serve our customers more effectively. We're using process to identify problems and implement solutions based on customer needs and recorded data that we use throughout the department. A couple examples would be the timeliness of our rulemaking and our response time to customer inquiries. We'll also be implementing a records management system to organize and manage electronic documents that are produced by or maintained by the division and subject to a retention schedule. We want to continue to shift our practices towards a paperless environment as much as possible. We want to increase our collaboration with other agencies. We are working with WorkSource Oregon to allow our preferred worker program staff to access the iMatch Skills job matching program. This is a system that matches a worker's work experience and interests with a job that requires the same experience and interests. The preferred worker program regularly gets inquiries from employers who want to find preferred workers and workers who want help finding employers interested in the preferred worker program. We'll be implementing a new streamlined vocational and return to work rule process. We've advised our administrative rules to make the employer and injury program, the preferred worker program, and the vocational program more accountable and user friendly. We want to make those programs to be as easy as possible for workers and employers to use and to ensure accountability for expenditures. The next slide represents a decrease in the cost of workers' compensation premium to employers per $100 in payroll. In 1990, employers paid $2.99 per $100 in payroll to workers' compensation costs, including the assessments that fund our regulatory activities and programs. Today, they pay $1.02 for $100 in payroll. So there's several factors that lead to these continued cost decreases. As I mentioned earlier, workplace safety programs have played a major role in this. In addition, the system has controlled medical cost growth. We've improved medical treatment, and this means that workers are returning to work sooner. and our return to work programs, the employee and injury program and the preferred worker program. This next slide demonstrates the number of disabled claims compared to two benefit categories being paid. As I mentioned, the disabling claim is a serious injury that results in lost time and wages. The blue line shows that the number of disabling claims has gone down since 2000, and the red line shows the benefits paid for temporary and permanent disability payments. So you can see the blue line dips significantly during the recession, and then a corresponding dip in the red line a couple of years out. When unemployment increases, there are fewer people in the workforce and fewer injuries, and therefore fewer benefits being paid. So even though the number of claims is going up with the employment growth in the last couple of years, the number of disability dollars paid to individual workers is actually still trending down. A major contributor for that is the shorter time loss because workers are getting back to work sooner. A couple of factors there, again, our return to work programs, and also when the economy improves, there's actually just an increase in demand for workers. If you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thanks for the opportunity to make this presentation. We are committed to a strong system. We are responsible for maintaining the integrity of a really healthy system, and we're committed to having one that's based on fairness.
Thank you very much, Mr. Savage. Colleagues, Senator Monroe.
I've always been impressed with the kind of job you've done. I'm particularly impressed with the way that the cost, the rate that you charge is adjustable given an increase or a decrease in your claims. So you keep a reserve that's adequate at all times. If the reserve trends down, then sometimes we bump up the fee a little bit and so on. And my understanding is that not all states do it that way. That some states, in fact, when they meet higher demand, have to borrow. And they borrow from the federal, and they borrow for zero interest. Is that still the case?
Co-chairs, Senator Monroe, there are a number of states that have just a state insurance system where there are no private insurers, and so they are the insurer. I'm not really familiar with how all of those work, but I can tell you that, as you say, the caution that some states use to build up a reserve is part of the problem. In our case, because there are either private insurers, including SAFE, or self-insured employers, those reserves are looked at by the department, either through the insurance division or the workers' comp division.
Your system never goes broke.
Well, I would say that to the extent that a self-insured employer has a problem, there are backstops to that. We do require adequate funding, but to the extent that that would happen, there are funds to backstop that, including the worker benefit fund. So the bottom line is that workers would never be put at risk.
Yeah. Thank you.
Co-Chair Johnson.
Representative Meek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the key performance measures we were talking about yesterday was part of the return to work program. You mentioned that part of the reduction of the claims was that you're getting folks back to work more, but are quicker. And it was KPM number 6. And I think that was one of the key performance measures we were talking about kind of deleting or not going by anymore. So I was just curious if those are two related or not. Those two measures are we just looking at?
Well, I guess I'll go ahead and jump in, Co-Chairs Representative Meek. The program that Mr. Savage was talking about was the return to work program and its importance to our overall system. The measure dialed in even more narrowly and within the context of injured workers looked at the economic performance, either in terms of time lost or in terms of wage replacement, of how those injured workers performed compared to other injured workers. And what we've proposed to do in our change key performance measure is keep working with that program, but focus on injured workers and how they perform versus workers who weren't injured, so that we can try to work on making sure the focus of the system is to make sure that injured workers get back to being whole or as close to whole as we possibly can. And so it's not a change in focus of the program, it's change in focus on what we want to measure. Yeah.
Great, wonderful. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay. Colleagues, any other questions for Mr. Savage? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we'll move on now to Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Division. While Mr. Wood comes up, I do want to correct the record on one point we talked about yesterday, and it was the rate of businesses where claims are filed and there isn't workers' compensation insurance in place. I grossly misstated our results because I misread our chart and thought that 2 was a percentage rate when it was actually incidents per 1,000. So it's actually 0.2 percent of businesses that are uninsured when there's a claim. So the number is actually extraordinarily low. With that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Mr. Wood.
Welcome, Mr. Wood. Sign in, please.
Thank you. Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Wood, and I'm the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We generally refer to that simply as Oregon OSHA. I appreciate the opportunity to spend a few minutes here to talk about our program. I do want to highlight some of the things that are significant in relation particular to Oregon OSHA. I will try to avoid duplicating the information that Director Allen gave you yesterday, as well as some of the information that that Mr. Savage has already covered because of the interwoven nature of the two programs. Oregon OSHA is one of 22 programs throughout the country that is operated under the approval of the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Act and is subject to the oversight of the federal government to operate a full occupational safety and health program under the Act. And that gives us the opportunity to run our own state program handling safety and health issues and really to control that part of our destiny. Our goal is to improve the safety and health of all Oregon workers, and we have over the last quarter of a century had a long and continuing record that has really shown a lot of success with that. If you look at the fatality rates, we've seen steady decrease in those rates. If you look at the injury and illness rate, whether tracking through the Bureau of Labor Statistics or through our own workers' compensation rates, you've seen steady decline in those rates. Mr. Savage has already talked about what's happened with the experience in the workers' compensation premium over that period. We like to think that part of the reason that we've been successful in seeing the workers' compensation premiums come down is that Oregon as a system has recognized that one of the most effective ways to control the cost of workers' compensation claims is to avoid those claims in the first place by eliminating the risks that cause injuries and illnesses and death. Oregon OSHA does a number of things. We, of course, set rules and inspect workplaces, but that's not the whole story. We help employers identify and eliminate hazards. We investigate workplace injuries and illnesses when they occur. We provide a number of resources that are designed to assist employers as well as to assist their workers in identifying hazards in the workplace and identify the best ways to eliminate those.
One question that I've got going back up to your worksite investigations. I have been aware through constituent work that every so often a disgruntled worker will call you guys and allege an unsafe condition in some workplace. How do you sort the real workplace inspections from ones that may not be meritorious?
Co-Chair Johnson, that's a good question, and that really happens on two levels. When we receive a complaint from a worker or from a former worker, we're obligated under the statute to look into those. The first thing we do is we screen the allegations in the complaint, both with regards to their specificity and their credibility, as well as with regards to their severity. The more serious the allegations are, the more likely we are to look into them specifically. Those are the cases where we want to make sure that we're not not wrong. So one of the things that we will do is assess the allegations and perhaps address them in a contact with an employer to inquire through what we call our phone fax system about issues that are there and to ask for a response from them. In those cases, we may still do an inspection if we're not able to resolve the issue. But the more significant way that we validate the issue, frankly, is in the inspection itself. Whether we do an inspection or not, the decision that we make about whether to issue a citation is based entirely on what we observe and what we determine when we conduct the inspection.
I haven't quite beaten this to death, so I'm going to ask one more question. Mr. Meek has a factory and has just fired an employee, and the employee calls you up and says, there's a ladder with no skid is missing off the steps, and it could be hazardous. You're not going to waste time and money on that, are you, absent making some inquiry whether or not there was a disgruntled employee? Or what level of due diligence do you do on the phone to find out whether or not this is worthy of dispatching somebody out to the facility?
Co-Chair Johnson, our focus is less on the motivation of the person filing the complaint and more on the credibility of the allegations. If they're able to give us specific allegations of what could be a serious issue in the workplace, the fact that their motivation in providing it may not be the best isn't as important to us as whether they're actually indicating a problem that is a serious problem in the workplace. And that's really what will determine whether or not we're likely to do the inspection.
Do you track outcomes in terms of founded or unfounded if you dispatch an inspection team to an employer?
Coach Johnson, we do. We track the results of our inspections, and we break that. We can and do break that down by the type of inspection. So it would include complaint inspection. In practice, our rate of violations is about the same with complaint inspections as it is for inspections that we do based on our scheduling system.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
As we look forward into the next biennium, we want to continue to maintain a strong presence in the workplace. One of the things that we believe has been a key to our past success is the fact that we have a relatively high presence, not only of enforcement staff, but also of consultants, people who are there to help employers and to help guide them in how they can comply with the rules and even to go beyond the rules. We want to continue our enforcement focus in the highest hazard industries and occupations. We want to continue our education focus, not only in those high hazard industries and occupations, but also in reaching out in particular to small employers. We give a priority when it comes to our on-site consultations to the smallest employers, as well as to those employers that we haven't done business with before. In our outreach focus, in addition to those elements, we also try to reach out to vulnerable and hard-to-reach workers, to workers who, for one reason or another, aren't necessarily getting the message in other venues, and so we try to reach out to them through a variety of educational techniques. We also work very hard to try to ensure...
Could you give examples?
Certainly, Co-Chair Johnson. One of the things that we do is we have what we call the PESO program, which is a program of train the trainer for that equips individuals to provide training to workers for whom English is not their primary language and Spanish is. It actually allows people who themselves are not necessarily strong Spanish speakers to use the training materials, and they're able to provide training to a workforce and bridge that language gap.
One follow-up, this came up in another committee that I serve on, and that is to what degree you are able to use new technology to do your trainings. It has come to the attention of the legislature that there are some agencies that are doing lots and lots of trainings that are dispatching a trainer to drive all the way to La Grande to meet with two people. And at a time of mounting budget austerity and constraint, reassure me that you're using all of the new technology at your disposal to do these trainings.
Co-Chair Johnson,
please note that Chair Johnson did not see this presentation before asking.
I see Director Allen has in fact moved to the next slide, and the first bullet there says use technology to increase employer and employee safety and health training. We actually made the shift a number of years ago to move away from in-person training, particularly in remote parts of the state, and it has been a somewhat painful shift to move toward more computer design training, more web-based training. We have initially, much of our web-based training was relatively simplistic. We were putting our PowerPoint presentations on the web so that people could read them there. What we have been doing over the last 2 years and what we plan to continue to make much more aggressive use of is actually using more interactive training tools so that we're actually using web-based technology in the most effective way so that we're providing computer-assisted training. Not only does it allow us to provide training in the remote corners of the state for a much more cost-effective means, it also allows us to provide that training when employers and their employees want it, so that we aren't as dependent on schedules. It has been a challenge. We had certainly had staff who were invested in providing training in person, and we had certain stakeholders who really liked the fact that we provided classroom training, but of course those were the ones who were able to take advantage of it. We are moving in that way. We haven't gotten as far as we intend to, and certainly as we would like to, but it's definitely the direction we're moving. It's definitely where the future has to take us.
Good. Thank you. Felix, please continue.
We also intend to continue our efforts to try to improve the clarity and accessibility of our rules through a variety of techniques. And from its inception, Oregon OSHA has been very dependent on partnerships and collaborations with our stakeholders, with the regulated community, with the folks that we work with to make safety and health in the state a reality. And we expect that to continue to be one of our critical aspects. This data on occupational injury and illness rates actually is one of the KPIs that you've seen previously. This doesn't have the line in it that shows the target. When that line is there, you know that we're continuing below the target. This actually illustrates, without that line, that the downward trend that is still there has flattened in recent years, and that is an area of a little bit of concern, and I'll come back to that somewhat in a moment. When you look at the fatality data...
Would you go back to the last one for just a second? Do you draw any conclusions from any of this in terms of the changing character of our workforce? If the dates were a little bit different, I'd wonder about indication that we weren't in the woods as much, or natural resource industries have been sort of steadily on the decline. Do you draw any conclusions from the period 2002 to 2015?
Chair Johnson, actually, the decline goes back much further than that as well, which does lead to questions about whether some of it is a result of the change in industry. We've actually looked at that closely, and the research staff at the department has looked at it, and one of the things that persuades us that it isn't simply a shift in industry is that when you look at each specific industry group, you also see a relatively comparable decline, so that while it is true that there is less logging than there used to be, it's also true that the rate of injury per 100 hours worked in logging has dropped dramatically. The same thing is true in construction, and of course the construction industry has grown. The rate of injury in construction has dropped dramatically. The rate of injury in heavy manufacturing has dropped dramatically. So almost without exception, we've seen the same kind of decline over the longer period. The other conclusion that I do draw is that in recent years it has flattened out. Now, a certain amount of that arguably is that the lowest apples on the tree have been picked, but we also do have concern that one of the things that's happened is that in recent years our enforcement presence as well as our consultation presence has declined relative to the size of the workforce we're regulating. And if you look at this slide that illustrates. One way of looking at the enforcement presence is if we were to simply set out to inspect every work site in our jurisdiction, 25 years ago it would have taken us 15 years to inspect every work site, which is still a relatively sizable period of time. Now we're at the point where it would take us 32 years. And that's part of the reason that leads us to the budget package that we have before you. Obviously, I'm not proposing to take it back to the previous levels, but we are interested in seeing at least that decline arrested so that we can stabilize our enforcement presence.
Thank you, Representative Noble.
Thank you. I'm curious, a couple slides back where you had showed the decline of illness and injury rates. I noticed that it's private sector. Curious how the public sector compares with the private sector.
Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Noble, that is a good question. In Oregon, as is true throughout most of the country, the public sector rate runs slightly higher than the private sector. The reason that we use the private sector rate for comparison is that in the Bureau of Labor Statistics data, it's available across the country. It provides a better baseline for comparison. It is true partly because of the mix of the nature of industries, partly for some other reasons that we may not fully understand, that the public sector rate tends to run just slightly higher, usually about a tenth of a point.
Yeah, I was curious. I come from the public sector, so those numbers look lower than my experience. So.
Do you do anything to coordinate inspections? I'm just when you're talking about reviewing all work sites, I'm just trying to think of a gas station mini mart. They've got food inspectors coming in there. They've got weights and measure inspectors coming in there. They've got chicken temperature inspectors coming in there. They've got local county public health. They've got you guys. At some point, I wonder when does the little local business guy say, why don't these guys kind of get it together and do coordinated inspections? Do you make any effort to lessen the burden on business by coordinating with your sister agencies?
Let me tackle that one if I could, Senator. You may recall an eon ago I ran something in state government called the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, and you actually are using what was my favorite example of what I considered to be the most regulated business in the state, which is running a convenience store, because you add to the things that you listed, underground storage tanks if they sell gas, and OLCC if they sell beer and wine, and the pharmacy board if they sell Advil, and all those sorts of things. And we actually did, in that exact context, a couple of different efforts around that kind of consolidation, both on the operations side and on the paperwork and fee-paying side. And a funny thing happened on the way to solving the problem. They hated it. They actually wanted that stuff spread out. A big whopping bill from the state for all of your permits and a big dissension of inspectors all at once was not something they considered an improvement in business. We had focus groups and surveys and those kinds of things and worked with industry lobbies, so this isn't, you know, just sort of a one-off. But that notion of being able to spread those things out over the course of a year was actually more favorable. And when combined with, at the time, this is going back probably 15 years now, huge technology issues across agencies that have gotten a lot better, we found that it was a huge lift for something that wasn't perceived to be that big a benefit. It surprised us. Surprised me quite a bit.
Surprises me. Cool. All right. Please continue, Mr. Wood. Oh, I apologize. Representative Meek. Sorry.
Reardon.
You guys look so much alike.
I know.
Representative Reardon.
I'm a lot better looking.
It's solved it both.
Anyway, thank you, Chair. Yeah. And I just question, don't know when to fit in here, but do you cover, regulate school districts and particularly shops in those school districts?
Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Reardon, we cover all employers in the state with the exception of the federal government. So the short answer to your question is yes. With regard to shops in the school district, we actually have jurisdiction only over employee exposure. So we don't, strictly speaking, have authority to address issues of student exposure if that's the underlying issue. Now, of course, generally the shop teacher is also exposed to any guarding issues.
Follow?
Yeah, just a comment. I taught shop for 7 years before my current gig, and I never saw an OSHA inspector, which was okay at the time. I was fine. But I was just curious about it. And so,
maybe. Well, if I could comment, Mr. Wood touched on targeting for and scheduling inspections. a big part of what we do. We talked about all that data that we gather, and when we need to improve our data gathering system on the claim side, we use that data to identify what are the job sites that are the most likely to generate risks and try to, although we talk about, you know, getting around once every 32 years, we don't randomly distribute our inspections. We actually try to focus on the work sites that are more likely to see injuries than not, and that would explain, I think, often some disparity of who thinks they have an inspector there all the time and who's seldom seen one.
I'm glad you didn't feel it necessary to target mine.
And so I'll just conclude with an observation about the policy package. The proposal before you would not restore our staffing to the 2009 level. It would offset the loss of boots on the ground, more than offset the loss of those positions. If you look at us compared to 2009, the overall effect would be that Oregon OSHA would be a slightly smaller organization than we were then, but we would have more staff in direct delivery of service in the field in the form of field enforcement staff and field consultants. There would be a reduction in administrative and managerial staff and a shift of that resource to direct service delivery. Thank you. I'm available for any questions you may have.
Colleagues, any other questions for Mr. Woods? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we changed the cast one more time, I'm going to touch briefly on our ombudsman function. The workers' comp reforms from the 90s created two separate ombudsmen within the agency, one for injured workers and one for small business. They both report directly to me rather than to the workers' comp system, in a way that's analogous to our internal auditor. Holly, why don't you come on up? In a way that's analogous to our internal audit function. So if there are issues that need to be brought to my attention, it's a direct report. Collectively, they field nearly 10,000 inquiries from either injured workers who are needing assistance in navigating the system to deal with claims, or businesses that are dealing with issues like access to coverage, classification of their business for rating purposes, and those kinds of issues. They're an integral part of the system. And help, I guess I would say, sand off some of the rough edges that an incredibly complex topic can present to either injured workers or to small businesses. I'm just going to touch on that briefly, but I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have specific to that area before I shift over to the board.
I actually do. I don't know if this bothers other legislators as much as it bothers me, but when there are units of government dealing with constituents, what's the reporting out mechanism to let me know that your ombudsman has engaged one of my constituents, or when the governor's ombudsman's office, or the Ruth Miles in the small business section at the Secretary of State? Do you have a reporting mechanism so that you would let me know we're dealing with Fred Smith in your district?
Boy, you know, Chair Johnson, prospectively, I can't speak to the other agencies. I don't know what systems they may not have. We don't have a prospective system that alerts you to all inquiries we might receive from an injured worker, a business that's having challenges, one of the several thousand people who call into our insurance advocates, other kinds of things. I'd want to think through with you how much of that traffic A, you'd want to see, and B, your constituents would be comfortable with us sharing with you. Certainly the other direction, when you and other legislators, as you often do, make us aware of circumstances, we then loop you into the ultimate resolution of those inquiries. But I would say we don't do anything on the front end if you weren't involved at the beginning.
And maybe the status quo is fine. I would say you've been very responsive when I've called and had issues with a particular constituent who's lifted up a problem for my consideration. So maybe it's fine, but it just was a curiosity to me.
Thank you. The last part of the worker safety system we'd like to talk about is the Workers' Compensation Board, as I mentioned yesterday. The chair and members of the board are independently appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, but are a part of DCBS from an administrative standpoint to talk about that program. I'm joined by Holly Somers, who's the chair of the board.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomber, members of the committee. My name is Holly Somers, and I'm chair of the Workers' Compensation Board. The Workers' Compensation Board is an independent agency within DCBS, Department of Consumer and Business Services. Our mission is to provide timely and impartial resolution of disputes arising out of the Workers' Compensation Law and Oregon Safe Employment Act. Today I'll give you a little context about how and why the agency was created, an overview about what we do to accomplish our mission, and finish up by telling you what we've accomplished with our relatively new web-based portal service and what we plan on accomplishing in the future. Because workers' compensation cases comprise the vast majority of our caseload, I'll talk about those first. By way of context, the workers' compensation disputes historically had been subject to the state civil court system and on the docket for judges throughout the state. However, about 50 years ago, the legislature provided for exclusive jurisdiction with the Workers' Compensation Board for any matter concerning a workers' compensation claim. In addition to creating a specialized forum with expertise in workers' compensation matters and freeing up the state court from this volume of cases, the legislature sought to minimize the adversarial nature of proceedings. So fast forward to 2017. Our hearings division received 6,900 requests for resolution each year, and the majority of these cases are resolved by way of settlement. Each settlement must be reviewed and approved by an administrative law judge. For the rest of the cases, we resolve these in two ways, either by holding hearings or providing mediation services. When a party requests a hearing, we set the hearing to occur within 90 days of receipt of the request. In part due to our electronic docketing system, we've been able to accomplish timely sets 98% of the time. Hearings are presided over by administrative law judges, all whom are members of the Oregon State Bar. Typically, the parties are represented by counsel. During the hearing, exhibits are admitted, testimony is taken, and oral argument is presented. At the conclusion of the hearing, and within 30 days of the record closure, the administrative law judges issue written decisions. And in 2016, 99% of the opinion and orders were timely issued. The second way we resolve disputes is through mediation. We have a very strong mediation program, and we see alternative dispute resolution as integral to our mission, and it's very popular with our stakeholders. Parties participate in mediation voluntarily, and the board provides these services at no cost to the litigants. In 2016, we held more than 300 mediations, resulting in a settlement 86% of the time. The hearings division is the front line of dispute resolution. There's also a second layer of administrative review, and that rests with board review division. The board consists of five full-time members who are appointed by the governor for four-year terms subject to Senate confirmation. To ensure that the interests of employees and employers are fairly represented, two members are appointed with a background in and understanding of the concerns of employees, and two members with a background in and understanding of concern of employers. The board chair, who is also the agency administrator, represents the interests of the public. Once appointed, all of the board members apply the law impartially. The five-member board is the appellate body that reviews the administrative law judge's workers' compensation orders on appeal. Sitting in panels of one employer member and one employee member, the panel reviews the written record from the hearings division as well as the appellate briefs filed on board review. Working together, the two members determine the appropriate outcome. If they are unable to agree, the public member serves as the tiebreaker. The board issues published orders on review, which are subject to appeal to the Court of Appeals. The members seek to maintain a high affirmation rate, which is currently at 86%. The Workers' Compensation Board is also the decision-making body for Oregon OSHA cases. These cases provide a means for employers to contest citations arising from workplace safety inspections. These are also due process hearings held by a specialized corps of administrative law judges in the hearings division. So last session, I reported on a new service to stakeholders, which was the electronic web portal. Since that time, the portal has grown significantly. This is the go-to method to transact business with the Workers' Compensation Board by an increasing number of stakeholders throughout the state, with the Workers' Compensation Board leveraging opportunities to, again, expand service. This technology enables stakeholders to file requests, submit documents, and access information in a secured, password-protected web environment. In addition to filing appeals electronically, portal users can now upload settlement documents to us for approval. By using the portal instead of the mail service, we can reduce the time it takes for injured workers to get their settlement proceeds and for insurers to clear their reserves. We receive about 300 settlements per month through the portal, which is about half of all the settlements that we receive. So looking to the future, the Workers' Compensation Board will continue to expand the portals to serve the needs of our stakeholders. As they rapidly are moving their own business records into an electronic environment, we're making it easier and less costly for them to use the Workers' Compensation Board's services. I'm available for questions.
Thank you very much for your very comprehensive testimony. Any questions, colleagues? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That concludes the portion of today's presentation that deals with the worker safety system. While we shift our cast, I'll take a moment and pause and see if there are any questions around that whole body of work that you have before we move on to consumer protection and safety.
I think we're good.
Very good. In that case, we'll move on to consumer protection and safety, and I'm joined now by Laura Callie Robison, who is the administrator of the Division of Financial Regulation and is the state's insurance commissioner.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Callie Robison. I'm the administrator for the Division of Financial Regulation, also known as DFR, within DCBS. And I'm very pleased to be here today to talk to you a little bit about what our division does. So I'll start by talking about our mission. So the mission of DFR is to protect Oregonians' access to fair products and services through education, regulation, and consumer assistance. Our scope is really quite broad. I think Director Allen talked about this a little bit yesterday in terms of the formation of the Division of Financial Regulation. But we regulate all state-regulated financial institutions, banks and credit unions, insurance institutions, and we regulate financial services really across the board, payday lenders, money transmitters, a lot of different various things that fall within our scope. In order to carry out our mission, we employ a couple of important key functions. First of all, really at the core of consumer protection is financial safety and soundness. So we ensure that our financial institutions are sufficiently capitalized to bear the risk that they take and protect their customers. So we do that by examining banks, credit unions, and insurance companies, and also keeping an eye on their finances. In the insurance context, that also means that we're ensuring that the rates are adequate, that they're sufficient to cover costs, but also not too high. We ensure that Oregonians are treated fairly when they actually interact with financial institutions and financial service providers. And we do this through compliance exams, through handling consumer complaints and outreach, and also reviewing products before they hit the market. We also hold individual financial professionals to high standards. So we set licensing requirements and also review financial professionals for compliance with our laws on a regular basis. And we also spend a lot of time educating and conducting outreach to the public. We really view an educated public as a really great tool to help protect against the potential for harm. Just to give you an idea, we fielded over 17,000 complaints and inquiries last year. And really that can range from an actual complaint to just asking a question or wanting to better understand how to go about finding an insurance advisor or a financial advisor.
As we how deeply do you get into some of these issues? I'm thinking during the mortgage crisis and drawing on my own constituent services in the office, we had people calling our office with unbelievably complicated mortgage situations. I know that you as the state agency cannot act as someone's legal counsel, but when someone calls you and says, I've been defrauded by XYZ mortgage company that sold my mortgage 28 times and I don't know who owns it now, how do you launch assistance under those circumstances?
Co-Chair Johnson, I think that's an excellent question. It actually hits on a couple of different areas that I'll talk about later today, too. But I think first and foremost, your question about when the consumer experiences any sort of problem with someone we regulate, we have a consumer advocacy and outreach division that handles consumer complaints and inquiries directly. So if we get a complaint that, you know, someone believes they've been treated badly or, you know, inappropriately, we'll immediately dive in and investigate that complaint. We'll ask the consumer for all the information that they have about what occurred. We'll also ask the entity or person that they're complaining about for their side of the story, and we'll try to resolve it if we can at that complaint level. If we, and this relates a little bit to mortgage servicing, which I'm going to talk about, we actually don't have authority over much of the mortgage servicing arena. We regulate those that are associated with banks, but actually something that we're seeking in one of our bills is to have authority over servicers. So we might run into a situation when a consumer comes to us where we don't have authority to act, but we might have a relationship with the entity and try to help resolve it, even if we can't force them to do so. If we can't get a resolution through the complaint process, we can take it up to up a notch and conduct an investigation and pursue an enforcement action.
Just if I could expand on that just briefly, because it's a common thought about us that's not quite accurate. You've not given us broad authority to go protect consumers or to go oversee financial services. What you give us are fairly discrete slices of authority to regulate discrete industries, state-chartered banks, pawn brokers, consumer lending organizations, and that happens in a bill where you set a fee and you give us authority to go deal with that industry. Part of our challenge and part of what led to the creation of DFR was the notion of how do we, within those discrete slices of authority, try to look holistically at the industry and do a more effective job of doing that regulation. But it's with that kind of a set of discrete slices of authority and not broad responsibility for all consumer protection.
And even just to kind of add to that too, when we have authority over certain different parts of the industry, we don't always have the same authority. So it may look different depending on the industry we're talking about. And I'm sorry, I think I saw that there might be a question.
Representative Noble.
Thank you. I have a question. It piqued my interest in insurance and that balance of ensuring that companies are viable, yet still profits are not out of line, and still provide some competition between different. Can you provide some sort of educational short summary for me? And how do you reach that? How do you even grapple that?
I would be happy to, co-chairs and Representative Noble. So, I mean, that really, I think, is the kind of crux of the difficulty in regulating the insurance industry and why, you know, I think one of the main reasons why it's important to have a regulator. We use a number of metrics on the financial side to help us assess whether an insurance company is appropriately capitalized. And so, you know, the more, I'd say, smaller, less complex insurers, that might be a more straightforward look if they have kind of, you know, fewer types of risks and, you know, they're kind of focusing on one type of insurance or maybe a handful of states. And so we'll look at different metrics there. It does get more complicated when we're thinking about insurers that might, you know, write in multiple states, might write different types of, different lines of insurance and kind of figuring out, you know, how well diversified the company is. But really, I mean, we rely on metrics in terms of kind of looking at, the risk that's inherent in their business and what modeling tells us is kind of an appropriate level of capital to be able to support that. We look at liquidity and how quickly they can meet the demands that they might need to pay claims. We look at the investments that they make. We actually also limit the nature and the amount of investments that they can make in risky assets so that they're protecting their consumers. And we do this on a continual basis. We actually go into an insurance company on site once every 5 years, and then we review quarterly and annual statements that give us a kind of a snapshot of their financial picture. And if we think there's a problem, we can always ask for more. But we are always kind of balancing that, and then also making sure that their rates is another place where we're looking to make sure that they're not charging too much, and therefore kind of acting in a way that's not in the consumer's interest, but that they're not lowballing and kind of putting the consumers at risk or being anti-competitive. I hope that's helpful, and I would be happy to provide more information too if you'd like.
Maybe at another time, but yeah, because it's intriguing to me, especially in trying to encourage a free market and still regulate it.
Thank you. Please continue.
Great. Thank you. So shifting gears a little bit and looking forward to the upcoming biennium, we're really focused on building on our core strengths, but also really supporting innovation that's occurring in a lot of the industries that we regulate, but making sure that consumers are protected along the way. So I'm not going to talk much more about the importance of financial safety and soundness. I think I've probably made that point, but we've lived through some experiences that have really underscored that that's kind of the ultimate consumer protection. We also are focusing on working closely with our stakeholders. We've made this a priority, and by stakeholders, I think of consumers, consumer groups, the industries we regulate, and those that kind of, you know, have relationships with the industry that we regulate that, you know, also touch consumers. And it's really key for us to keep in great touch with our stakeholders, especially as the pace of innovation continues to accelerate. We're also working on modernizing and streamlining our customers' abilities to work with us. So one example of that is using a national electronic licensing system for mortgage lending and other financial services. Health insurance obviously remains a really critical issue, and so we're continuing to focus our oversight of the health insurance industry, and also our focus on rate review being a very transparent and, you know, balanced process. We're also looking forward to the next biennium as a way to continue our work in integrating our approach to financial regulation. So we have a dedicated compliance and enforcement units that are already allowing us to take action more quickly and developing those teams to be able to prevent harm or minimize harm before it occurs. We're leveraging our advocacy and outreach team, as I mentioned before, to help better educate the public and to really try to prevent harm again before it occurs. And we're also looking for ways to target our outreach efforts to more vulnerable populations, seniors, and those who are of less means. So before we move on to, I've got a couple of specific budget requests to talk through. I just wanted to highlight the scope of the industry that we regulate. So what you see here in front of you is just a kind of high-level summary of the entities we regulate, about how many licensees we have, the number of complaints we received, and also the number of exams we conducted. And I wanted to share this to you, first to just give you a picture of all the different things that we look at, but also to highlight one of the areas that we're going to be focusing on in the upcoming year. Before we were one division, we had two slightly different approaches to handling issues that came through our door from consumers. On the insurance side of things, a lot of resolution of consumer issues was done through our complaint handling process, and that's where you would see recoveries for the public happening through resolution of complaints. On the finance side, while we had a complaint process where you saw more action that resulted in kind of a financial, you know, either restitution or trying to make consumers whole, it was actually happening through an enforcement action. One of the challenges on the financial side is by the time you get to an enforcement action, sometimes the fraud or other violation is so great that there may not actually be any money left to make consumers whole. And on the insurance side, you know, we also see opportunities to use our investigation and enforcement efforts more as well. So we think that there's probably a middle ground approach to dealing with more finance issues on the complaint side and also leveraging our compliance exam and enforcement efforts on the insurance side. So that's something that we're going to be focusing on in the upcoming year as well.
Senator Hansen.
Excuse me. Back to just from my own, an insurance producer, is that like an agent, or what's a producer?
Co-chairs and Senator Hansel, yes, an insurance producer is an insurance agent. It would also include a broker, so depending on kind of whose behalf you're working on. Okay, and so I will finish up here by quickly talking about our two POPs. We have POP 103 and 104. The first of these is not attached to a bill, but it actually complements one of the bills that we've proposed, Senate Bill 96, that requires investment advisors and broker-dealers to carry E&O insurance. So this is not related to the bill, but kind of similar topic. We've had several recent examples, both here in Oregon and nationally, of investment fraud and other violations that have resulted in pretty serious consumer harm. And often it's difficult to identify these issues before they occur, and by the time that we get to them, the money's gone, and it's really difficult for us to make consumers whole. We do have examination authority, and we conduct exams of our investment advisors and broker-dealers at least every 3 years. But we think that we need to be doing more robust safety and soundness exams, because really at the root of some of the fraud issues that you see is an underlying financial issue. And we think if we can get to that more quickly, we'll have a better chance of preventing this harm, or at least of catching it before it becomes more of a severe issue. So specifically here, we're requesting an additional examiner to help us enhance that exam capability. And then our second request, POP 104, relates to Senate Bill 98. And this is actually relates back to Co-Chair Johnson's earlier question. That bill would give us authority to regulate non-bank mortgage servicers. So servicers are really a key point of contact for consumers once their loan is closed. So typically the servicer is who the consumer is making their payment to. The servicer is responsible for applying that payment to the, getting it to the actual holder of the note and paying taxes, managing escrow accounts and the like. We actually receive a significant number of complaints that relate to servicers we don't regulate. Over 80% of our complaints are really out of our jurisdiction currently. And we hear a lot of different things, from misapplied payments to mishandled foreclosures. And these are really serious issues, as I'm sure you can imagine. So Senate Bill 98 would establish a licensing requirement and also allow us to investigate complaints and conduct safety and soundness exams of non-bank mortgage servicers. And so we're also requesting an examiner position to support that authority. And with that, I'm happy to answer any other questions that you may have.
Representative Meek and then Representative Reardon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question about the POP 103. You mentioned something about E&O insurance? Is that what I thought?
Yes.
This is the bill that I couldn't remember yesterday, and I was crossing my wires between the two.
So co-chairs and Representative Meek, yes, so Senate Bill 96, which is not, it kind of complements this, but it's not actually tied to the fiscal request, is a bill that would require investment advisors and broker-dealers that have discretionary authority to trade client funds or have custody of client funds to carry $1 million of E&O insurance. And I should have actually mentioned that the focus here was on those investment advisors and broker-dealers that have that discretionary authority, or they actually have custody. Okay. Of the funds.
Okay, great.
If I could just add quickly to that, the theme of both these efforts is to try to shift from where we've historically been of finding out that someone's been behaving badly and going out and punishing them, to trying to figure out how to find out at the beginning of the time that they're behaving badly and stop it, so that we can actually prevent consumer losses rather than simply punish malfeasance after the horse is already out of the barn.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. Yeah, well, that's my question about the errors and omissions. If they're intentionally defrauding, how would that insurance actually help, make somebody whole? Is there a policy?
Co-chairs, Representative Meek, that is an issue that we actually discussed in our policy hearing about the bill. And so typically what happens is that this is when you've gotten to a level of making a claim, there are usually a number of different ways it can be argued about what occurred in the circumstances. And so in talking with attorneys that have helped investors who have been defrauded, there are often ways to be able to access that insurance, even if there are at least potential allegations or kind of the whiff of fraud. And so they've been successful in finding that there are other ways either to access directly the investment advisor, or often you might have an investment advisor who's employed by a broker dealer, and you might be able to access the insurance coverage by the firm that they're employed with. So they're in our researching this, certainly you do run into issue with actually criminal acts and exclusions in insurance policies, but we do think that this would actually be helpful. Incidentally, it's a best practice for a lot of investment advisors already to carry this, but it's probably the ones that we're concerned about that probably need to have the requirement imposed on them, and that's been our approach in proposing the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Reardon.
Thank you. I have two questions. May I ask them?
Fire away.
Thank you. Two unrelated questions. Do you have jurisdiction over online loan companies?
Co-chairs, Representative Reardon. So, yes, consumer finance lenders and mortgage lenders under certain circumstances, if they're lending online, do still have to have a license with us. I can follow up with you kind of with the specifics of kind of when they do have to be licensed with us versus not. But you're touching on, I think, an area of complexity that we're actually wading into, not just with lending, but with a lot of financial services. It gets more difficult depending on where the company is based, whether they have branches, do they themselves have to be licensed, or do the individuals that work for them have to be licensed?
It followed Representative and then Senator Hansel and then Co-Chair Gomberg.
And then and I think I heard something on the radio the other day that the feds are considering allowing insurance to be sold across state lines. So would that impact your ability to protect consumers in Oregon?
Co-Chairs, Representative Reardon. So yes, there's a lot of discussion about the ability to sell, in particular, health insurance across state lines. And as I've understood the proposals, or at least the policy idea behind this, we do believe that that would actually reduce our ability to protect consumers, because what the way that it's been framed out is allowing an insurance company out of state to sell a product that complies with the laws of the state that the insurance company is based in. So I don't want to pick on a state, but let's say that, you know, Nevada has, for example, different laws than Oregon. And so could a Nevada company sell a policy that complies with Nevada laws but falls short of Oregon laws? That's the concern that we would have, is kind of losing the ability to actually, affect the consumer protections. Really, the ability to really sell across state lines exists today, and that an insurance company can get a license in any state as long as it meets those states' requirements, and then but just has to follow that state's law in terms of what the policy covers.
I'd add one point to that, and that's that when your constituents call us today with concerns, we've got regulatory authority to be able to deal with those concerns. In a scenario where sales are across state lines in the way we think they would be, last week we were using Louisiana as the state to pick on, your constituent would need to call the Louisiana Insurance Commissioner, who's accountable to the voters of Louisiana, I think, in that particular case. And it's less likely that an Oregonian would, we believe, be treated well in that kind of a scenario than they are now.
Yeah, unfortunately, that actually does still occur, because we have employers who are, you know, based in other states, who have employees in Oregon who have coverage that complies with other state laws, and they'll call us, and we'll try to do the best we can, but we don't always have jurisdiction, even if the person resides in Oregon.
Thank you.
Senator Hansel?
This might be a loaded question, and forgive me if it is, but if the other two bills pass, but you don't get the people that you're requesting these POPs, will you be able to administer those?
Co-chairs and Senator Hansel, so on the first POP, even though it kind of, I'd say complements the bill that we have, it's not tied to the bill. So if Senate Bill 96 were to pass and we were not able to get the additional examiner on the security side, we would not, our ability to enforce Senate Bill 96 would not be affected, but we think we'd have less effectiveness in being able to conduct more in-depth financial exams of investment advisors and broker-dealers. On Senate Bill 98, those are tied together in terms of the request for the additional position. We think to be able to handle the volume both of licensure and really getting into the depth of the financials of these non-bank mortgage servicers, we think it would be really important for us to have that person on board.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Gumbert.
Thank you, Co-Chair, and thank you, Ms. Robinson. Something Representative Reardon said just sparked a question in my mind, and it may be a little bit of a stretch here, but it goes to what real life is like for small businesses out there in Oregon. Because on an average of 3 to 5 times a day, the phone rings at my office back over in Lincoln City, and it's somebody I've never heard of who is calling me up to offer me refinancing, long-term financing, debt consolidation, and credit card opportunities. And it has gotten so intense that in one of my retail stores, they simply stopped answering the phone. They let everything go to voicemail and then return the real calls, because they don't want to step away from real customers to take these annoying, unwanted, unsolicited phone contacts. I've got you here in front of me. I just thought I'd ask.
Co-Chair Gomberg, I have to say that I don't know kind of off the top of my head all that may apply to solicitation from all these different areas. I think one of the challenges is where these solicitations are coming from, whether they're coming from someone we regulate or not. Sometimes it's not always clear. It could be coming from someone we license or someone who's doing that activity without a license, which is obviously more concerning to us. Sometimes it can even be done from someone out of state who's, kind of not aware of what the requirements are. But I would be happy to follow up and maybe provide a little bit more information about what requirements we have and kind of where the scope of our authority is. But it is, we know that that's a challenge, and one of the things we focus on in terms of consumer education is, I guess if you're going to answer the phone, helping you to be able to kind of pick out red flags and know when you might be, primed for being scammed.
You also raise an interesting issue in that where we do have authority, almost always that authority is with respect to consumers, not with respect to business. Business-to-business transactions, are, with a couple of minor exceptions, are not part of our regulatory authority. But it does raise kind of an interesting issue we've thought about periodically, which is the line between a consumer and a small business is a lot finer than many might think. We've not comprehensively gone and tried to come back to you with a proposal for how we should change our regulatory authorities to deal with small businesses as though they were consumers. But you kind of opened the door to that sort of a discussion with that question.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I appreciate your comments. The line between an interruption or a scam and a hardworking small business should be a little stronger. Madam Co-Chair, just watch for my proposed legislation increasing the penalties in Oregon for abusing the do not call list and harassing people with unwanted phone calls.
Well, I thought I was so special in that I was the only one that got those calls. We discovered part of it was leasing a copying machine and finding out that triggered a UCC filing, and immediately after that we had everybody in the planet trying to help refinance debt that didn't exist. It is incredibly annoying. And the credit card stuff, this is your last chance to zero your rate. I've had 5,900 last chances. It's getting annoying. So bring it on.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. You got anything else?
More for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Great. Next. Then I would ask Mark Long with the Building Codes Division to come up and talk about his program area. This is an interesting one for us in that it's a little bit consumer protection. It's a little bit safety. In terms of a uniform development environment around the state, it's a little bit jobs and economic development. With that, I'll turn it over to Mark Long.
Thank you, Director Allen. Members of the committee, Chair Gomberg, Chair Johnson, my name is Mark Long. I'm an administrator of State Building Codes, part of DCBS. I'll talk a little bit about what we do at Building Codes. I'll talk a little bit about what our purpose is, what we're working on, and then some of the future issues for us. So first of all, slide up. Great. We adopt state building codes across 130 different cities and counties. So for those new committee members that I haven't worked with before, in Oregon, we have a unique system where the standards we adopt at the state then are applied uniformly around each city and county so that businesses that work in multiple areas have assurances that the requirements are the same regardless of the community they work in. It's the floor and the ceiling for regulation, and that's very unique to Oregon. There's only a couple other states that have a model similar to ours. It's a kind of fully integrated system, and we're very proud of the system that we have. As part of adopting the code, we also address appeals and dispute resolution. These are issues where a business may have a disagreement with local government over a particular code call. They can come to the state and get a resolution either through staff or through one of the advisory boards we work through. We train all the local government inspectors. We certify them. It's effectively such as similar to licensing, and provide their continued education so that we have that kind of consistent application of that state standard across those different jurisdictions. We license subcontractors. So in Oregon, I believe you had some questions on Construction Contractors Board yesterday. If you're a general contractor, you go to that agency. If you're a subcontractor, you come to our organization, and we license the plumbing contractors and electrical contractors, folks who work on boilers and elevators, that kind of subcontractor work. We work for those folks. We're also a provider of service for what I call last resort. Many communities may choose not to provide those services, so we run full programs to provide those services to the contractors in those areas where cities and counties choose not to. And then one of the key things that we're doing here more recently
Mr. Long, stop for just a second. When you say cities and counties may choose not to, does that become a fee-for-service arrangement with your shop, or what keeps every city and county from dumping those responsibilities on you?
So, Madam Co-Chair, let me just kind of start at the top. The way it works is the program starts at the state. Counties then may elect to get into the business. They decide whether there's adequate revenues and activity to provide those services. If they don't, then the state carries it out. And then the cities can assume from the state, but within that county, if you will. So when a county takes over a program, I hope I haven't jarbled this up too much, when a county takes over the program, they are required to cover all cities, but then a city may come in and pick up different pieces. They'll set their own fee rates, they'll set their own staffing, and they'll hopefully have enough activity and revenue to carry out those programs and provide all the services that they're required to provide under the state building code system. What happens is, primarily in the county areas and rural areas, when communities have either increases of activity or lose, you got a two-person shop, three-person shop, you lose somebody, they'll ask us to come in and help out. So there's kind of two models where we work. We'll do partnership agreements where we work out revenue sharing based on what the workload is, and we have lots of different models. Or again, where we're the full provider of last resort, we actually carry out those services because the counties have chosen not to. Coos County, Umatilla County as an example.
And how are you reimbursed in Coos, for example?
When we perform the services in Coos County, we are the direct service provider. We collect the dollars directly.
Thank you.
Everybody else,
thank
if you,
you
will.
Yeah, we run the Coos County Building Department.
Okay.
Effectively.
Yep. Cool. Thank you.
Okay. So we provide those services in kind of that patchwork quilt to make sure that contractors are getting their permits and getting their inspection services timely. It's a key piece of what we do, kind of the economic development side. And then we work with seven advisory boards that are broken up amongst the various industry clusters. Again, as an example, we have an electrical board and a plumbing board and a boiler. I won't go through all of them, but it's broken up by industry sector that helps advise us on code adoption, licensing matters, disputes, and all the things that are under our rubric. The purpose of that system is to provide that predictable business environment. So again, the standards are the same, and to make sure that we have equal protection in all communities statewide, and that's kind of what we work on. Looking forward, great, we've got the data up there. I like to kind of just share data that's going on in the construction industry. We view 2011 as kind of the end of the recession from a construction standpoint and the beginning of the build-out. Now, other economic metrics are different, but that's kind of from our general viewpoint. And so construction employment, as an example, is up 28%. From that 2011 time frame. When you look at the statewide building permits up here, these are all the permits that are sold in local communities. We kind of monitor that. It gives us a sense of what's going on out there. Up 35% since 2011. So there's a lot of issues about making sure that we stay on top of service delivery and that we're making those transactions as easy as possible for consumers. If you kind of look at what we're doing now, we make sure construction is timely and safe. I share with folks that you have an exhaustive process in Oregon where you go through your natural resources reviews, planning, zoning, etc. When you get to our organization or to our local government partners, we want to make sure our services are timely and that the buildings are built right, they're built safely. That's kind of our primary focus. We want to make sure the services are flexible for the customers, that they have choices. We don't like one-size-fits-all building code standards, so even though it's a statewide code, there's lots of options for folks to kind of solve their various problems.
Mr. Long, you've just said two interesting things. Make sure they're built right.
Yes.
And then the statewide one-size-fits-all comment. What are you doing about conforming your codes to the changing external environment? For example, some folks' enthusiasm with tiny houses now, and what code applies to a 300-square-foot living area that is ostensibly someone's house.
Sure.
And the other thing that I was just introduced to yesterday, and colleagues, this is fascinating, the possibility that there could be a, and I know a little of the answer to this one, but the possibility that there could be a 12-story cross-laminated building in the Pearl District of Portland, Oregon having competed, or a team representing Oregon having successfully competed for a federal tall building prize, and they get to build this building. How are you adjusting your statutes, your approach to your business to comport with the changing external landscape?
Sure. Co-Chair Johnson. So I'll take the last one first because it's a little bit more straightforward. Tiny house has got a lot of complications to it, and I'll do the best I can to answer that question. On the cross-laminated timber, just so that the committee knows, Oregon is leading the nation and will, if this project goes forward, which we anticipate that it will, lead the world in the type of design related to using timber, these panels, to build a taller wood story building. And the reason why Oregon's unique, I won't bore you with all the construction details, but we're using an actual interesting rocking wall system here in Oregon that nobody in the world used to deal with your seismic and your construction issues to create an open floor plan. Normally it's built off the side, so it's very fascinating. So to answer your question, those projects are being administered by the state because we have flexible tools and we want to make sure in Oregon that we can work with both the manufacturers of the product but the contractors, the designers worldwide on this basis. The code is is brought in, is designed two ways. There are prescriptive requirements for things that we know about. We know how to build a regular house, and we know how to build regular office buildings and restaurants and those things. We call that prescriptive standards. But we also create an outcome-based set of standards for performance. So as long as you can show us through design and through review that something is safe from a fire standpoint or a structural standpoint or a seismic or getting people in and out of the building, you can design a building any way you want. And I often tell folks that, you know, there's not a space needle code for Seattle, but they were able to build that, okay, because there's a performance standard for that. And if you spend any time in Las Vegas, there are very interesting buildings down there, all coming out of the building code and allowing folks, when you have kind of a flexible organization that's willing to work with the designers and developers, there's performance standards for those different unique buildings to meet. So that's how we deal with it on kind of the CLT or the larger types of projects. Tiny houses is a little bit more challenging.
I want to make this point for you.
Sure.
Because it bears emphasis. Your agency is permitting that Pearl building.
Correct.
And I just think that we ought to put a finer point on that. I knew it, but I just wanted to make sure that was clear. This is cutting-edge stuff. And that building is gorgeous. It'll be affordable housing, retail space, commercial space in one of the most desirable neighborhoods in Oregon. And it's a big deal.
Madam Co-Chair, it'll be the third building we've worked on in this space. I think we finished the Bounty Yard project up there, a four-story building, and we're working with a Carbon 12, which is another. I shouldn't say because I'll guess wrong on the amount of stories. And then we have this project. This project will be the most unique and trend-setting in the world, and we're very excited about that. So, cool. And that's just a special provision of having a state system that allows the customers to come to us to kind of work these issues out. Once we figure out all these complex issues, we'll take that information, we'll turn it back to the local government, we'll develop code standards. I'll just share with you, we typically will not write code standards for new technology out of the gate because, frankly, sometimes those are awfully conservative. And then when you go to change them down the road, you're changing codes, and then people have a problem with that. So we like to get in there, sort out the problem, figure out the best way to move forward, work with the designers, and then based on experience, actually adjust the code accordingly. Well,
so now go to tiny houses.
Okay. So tiny houses is a little bit more complicated in that the building code, it doesn't set a size threshold. There isn't a large house code, and there isn't a small house code. What we have are folks who want to build smaller products, which the code allows. We've had difficulty getting that across to folks. We provided training to local government. I got a whole PowerPoint presentation I did in a room just the other day over here at the legislature. The real issues around tiny houses come down to licensing. We haven't found the builders of that product get their Construction Contractors Board licensing because they want to call the product an RV instead of a house. They don't use licensed electricians. They don't use licensed plumbers. And then they have difficulty with how to design lofts that wouldn't compromise exiting and egress and then smoke inhalation for consumers. We'll be working with, I'll just announce it here today, we'll be working with the Association of Architects in Oregon here to work because of the problems we found with the people who want to get in the space and maybe not understanding how to build or do it according to code. We work with them to develop standard floor plans to make available to the folks because the code allows this. You just have to kind of understand what some of the issues are.
I would hope also
and there's a whole bunch of other issues I could ramble on about if you'd like, but probably not.
I would hope that you would add the home builders to that conversation because inequity in the marketplace is breathtaking. They're held to all kinds of standards, and Representative Meek, who's a realtor, is nodding. And you got somebody else that's building, you know, a box on a couple of wheels, and there is potential for great inequity, in my opinion.
Madam Co-Chair, you hit the nail on the head. I didn't go through all the issues, but when you talk about how these things impact transportation policy, systems development charges, schools excise taxes, contractor issues, business licensing, other licensing, again, the code, you can build these things. We figured out how to do it down to 160 square feet of building codes. We just haven't seen anybody do it yet and follow all of the different regulations that every other builder has to follow.
And I think implicit in your litany of horribles is that if the legislature falls in love with this notion too quickly, there could be all kinds of unintended consequences.
I've tried to tread lightly on this issue, but you've hit the nail on the head.
Please continue.
All right. I think what I'll do is, because we covered a lot of things, I just want to kind of the walk away is our organization is there to make sure the standards are equal for business, that we provide that protection, that we're a relief valve when communities need help or projects need help. And we're also very interested in workforce. And I guess if I was to look forward, workforce in our organization, we believe that over the next 10 to 15 years, we're going to have as many as 80% of the local government inspectors leave the profession. We need to get those folks trained. We're looking at different ways to bring people into the profession than the traditional model. The traditional model is you worked in the industry for a period of time, potentially got injured or hurt, then you came to be an inspector. We need to start building people from the very beginning, and we've started partnering up with our high schools and reducing the barriers on the inspector side to kind of address workforce. Technology is going to be a big issue for us. I think I've talked to you about e-permitting an awful lot. If you look at the number of permits and those transactions, the way you make the system work is you put it in an electronic format. We're looking at video inspections. Drones are going to be a thing of the future. Those are all the things we're trying to get our head around. And then just the ongoing challenges of making sure that rural Oregon has the same level of services that the urban areas have. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Cool. Any questions? Representative Rudin.
Thank you. Thanks for your presentation, Mark. It's great stuff. I have many questions, but I'll just limit it to one. You talked about, I think, licensing the trades workers. Mm-hmm. And could you talk a little bit about how they are assessed, or do you do an assessment on them as well?
Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Reardon. Mostly on the trade side, they come out of the apprenticeship is required in Oregon, right. And so they come through apprenticeship programs that are established by the contractors or through the associations that provide those training centers. So generally what happens is, as an example, electrician requires 8,000 hours, I believe, which is 4 years of apprenticeship program. Once they get that certificate that's regulated through BOLI, okay. We see that, then we issue the license. Now, that's a simple answer. There are obviously more complexities. We can look at experience and kind of peel back when it's out of state. But that's the general, they come out of apprenticeship programs.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
That gives rise to one other question on my part. Under your leadership, there were conversations about merging building codes and Construction Contractors Board. Any progress to report?
No.
Okay. And another progress report, have you figured out how not to destroy airplanes with foam in hangars?
Yes.
Good. All right. Colleagues, any questions? There being none, any good of the order, Mr. Steiner? Okay. We're adjourned. Thank you for your presentation.